So we've got time for a couple questions from the audience. Who would like to start?
I noticed that with the conservation efforts, like at Terre Haute, that there has been efforts, and now there is a new machine, especially down at the Bay, etc., where they're pumping clean water in, and it's literally reversed the chemical process. My big concern is the various chemical thing there. How do you think this sets an example to industry in the area and around the world when things like numbers become infected versus how does it reflect on data that you're involved?
That's a fascinating question. You know, how does the kind of new processes of water filtration affect Toronto, et cetera. And I'm certainly not an expert on water filtration. But what has been happening around water filtration, and actually it's Toronto is not in the forefront of this, is that is using natural systems to filter water. So Chicago has reintroduced marshlands. There used to be tons of marshlands at the base of the Don Valley. Those were all eliminated, but those are natural filtration systems. And so part of the invitation now is, yes, I mean, we're using human technology and ingenuity, and that can be great. But there are also natural systems that we've removed that were doing filtration in a very effective way. And it wasn't realized until many years later that this was gone. This is illustrated in a film called Lost Rivers. And for those of you involved in water issues, it's a great film. It's a very hopeful film, actually, because it deals with the daylighting of rivers around the world and bringing them back. And in the city of London, England, which led the burial of rivers in the 1840s and 50s with great cholera epidemics, etc., they're now helping lead the charge to daylighting those rivers and using natural filtration systems in marshlands and parklands to filter water. So there's a kind of movement away from burying the rivers. It's kind of a fun film, too, because you see the city of Yonkers, New York, just north of New York City, where their main sawmill river was basically buried in a parking lot put over. And people talked about this for years. And you see these kind of older guys in canoes, you know, going through, like, these stenchy tunnels. I think we should daylight this river, you know, historic footage. And then you see them beginning to daylight the river and the excitement and the joy as they start removing the parking lot and unearthing this large sewer tunnel that the Sawmill River is in. Today it runs right through the heart of Yonkers. Where's the parking lot? And now fish are coming back from the ocean into there, they're claiming. Seoul, city of in Korea. They had a six-lane highway that they opened in 1960, and you see the footage, buried a river to it. They've removed the highway and have daylighted the river. That's featured there. And so what you see is not only the ecological benefits, but the social, cultural, and emotional benefits of people now going there. So in the Seoul situation, you see a lot of newlyweds going to the river downtown and have, you know, and celebrating their newlywed status and having photos taken and going. I mean, this is very interesting in terms of urban planning, and I know there's some urban planners here in the room. Relationship to waters is key for your vital urban space. When you embrace the water rather than turn your back on it, and we in Toronto really kind of turned our back on Lake Ontario, you can have a very vital, dynamic community, particularly when you preserve the integrity of your water. You all know Bernie Sanders, right? Bernie Sanders, right? You all know that he was mayor of Vermont, Burlington, Vermont, mayor of Burlington, Vermont, which is now considered one of the top 50 places to live in the United States. Well, I remember when I was a student at McGill, talking to the older residents, they said, oh, back in the 50s and 60s, Burlington was a hole. You never wanted to go there. It was a post-industrial, rusted out, you know, armpit. It came back. Why did it come back? Well, one reason is when Bernie Sanders ran for mayor, he said the waterfront of Lake Champlain is for the people, not for the developers. And he won. So you have a boardwalk, you have a beach, you have an aquarium, and then he put the main shopping district right in the center, pedestrian friendly. So you have a beautiful, vital shopping area, not car laden. You have public access to the lake, and now it's one of the top 50 places to live in the United States. it takes a socialist to rebuild your capitalist economy. The question is about the motivation of selling water in the aquifers to places like Nestle's, etc. This is a very important question, and one that I certainly can't provide a full answer to, but I can share what little I know. Interestingly, in Aberfoyle, of course, Nestle's is pumping out an incredible amount of water. They were paying $3.71 for every million liters until recently. The Wellington Water Watchers were among those who were claiming this is extraordinarily ludicrous, particularly in a time of drought, as we experienced last year. They petitioned the Wynne government to change that. The government did, and they now charge a lot more money for that. They are now charging an incredible increase in the amount. I'm just looking here for the factoid, but it's an incredible jump. Nonetheless, this is still treating water as a commodity. This is not taking the water out to use in bottling for lemonade or for soda pop or something. This is direct water. So they take it out, they put it in a bottle, and they sell it. This, I contend, is still immoral. This is still commodifying water. The Wynne government said when those permits were given 30, 40 years ago, no one thought that anyone would just take water out, bottle it, and sell it because you had a public water system. I remember as a little kid, maybe some of you remember this, you know, you have these futuristic kind of joke magazines, what you might see in the future, and one of the fake ads was a gallon of water for $1.98. You know, like, how absurd. You'd pay for water? So the Wynne government said this was an absurdity when this was given, so it has to be rectified. So they have increased the price for water. But I think they're playing a game, in a sense. They don't want to go fully to the extent of saying water can no longer be a commodity, but they do see the absurdity of charging only $3.71 for every million liters. So they've increased the price, but not the overall process. And I think what we're being asked to think about is that overall process. Should water be seen just as a commodity, be pumped out, put in a bottle? You've probably seen many of these studies that have taken 20 to 30 different types and varieties of bottled water and done the testing. Often in a third of them have just come from tap water, and it's, you know, mislabeled. Others are not as clean and pure as the purified government municipal water that is supplied. So it's not as if, you know, this is any safer. In addition, the amount of plastic that is being produced from those waters is unbelievable. And we and our wildlife are choking on it, literally. I mean, there's an incredible documentary about Midway Island in the Pacific, a site of a 1942 major battle in the World War II between Japan and the United States, in that particular battle, and a major naval battle surrounding it. When you look at this documentary now and you see all these albatrosses and seabirds choking and dying, and they open them up and they're all filled with plastic. There is so much plastic from these bottles in our oceans, it's killing our ecosystems at one level. And so that's another moral layer on the plastic bottling industry. Yes, in the back. That's a great question. Like, if there's an emergency and there's no water available, what do people do? You know, we're seeing, as you well know, in terms of the rising water levels, owing to a variety of factors related in part to climate change, the melting of ice caps, but also other kinds of increased violent storms, incredible hurricane rise in typhoons, etc. People are experiencing the elimination of their homelands. So small island nations are actually being submerged. So, you know, there's a kind of flooding happening, so people are losing their homelands. The Maldives is a case in point, where people of the Maldives are losing incrementally their homeland. So what are the policies around, you know, rescuing them? That's one issue. I just noticed in the Toronto Star an article about this issue with our people in condos and high-rises. What's going to happen if the water is cut off or if the electricity, there's some kind of emergency, and you have hundreds of people in these high-rises, 60, 70, 80 feet above, you know, the street level? How are you going to get to them, et cetera? It's a question that planners are very, you know, concerned about, and certain others, like how vulnerable are our populations here to this kind of thing? But in terms of national or international strategies, I don't know what's there. I mean, I don't. Many places you saw with Katrina in the United States, what a disaster that was, with people on rooftops for a whole week not being rescued, and you have the largest military in the world that has helicopters, naval vessels, all kinds of craft. Where were they rescuing their own people? And again, the issue of who got rescued and who didn't became an issue, because many of these areas were poor, with people of color, and the issue of who gets to be saved and who doesn't in these disasters becomes an issue. So again, I think that these issues that we talked about earlier in terms of environmental racism, in terms of oppression of people at the margins of the culture, they come into play when these emergencies happen around water as well. So the environmental crisis runs along the same fault lines of our social, ecological, political, gender depression. And so things that happen normally, where certain people are considered somewhat disposable, this is exacerbated in international situations, I'm afraid. Yes, sir.
I believe it was in Michigan recently, outside of the Great Lakes Water Basin, the watershed, a municipality was given a right to collect water from this watershed. In other words, they went over the hill.
Ah, okay.
Is that the start?
That's really scary. I mean, to hear that. Of course, this is the great concern of Maud Barlow, who is the great paladin of water in the world from Canada, that if that starts happening, then her interpretation of the NAFTA agreement, of course, this is pre-Trump, who knows what will happen post-Trump, but once that starts being sold as a commodity, then all the water is open for sale in terms of that international trade. So if what Maud Barlow is saying, you know, in terms of the NAFTA agreement, holds up, this could be very damaging because it sets a precedent, and then water becomes a commodity under NAFTA. So that's why she has been so active in trying to prevent this commodification of water and the sale of water. Interestingly, again, another book that might be of interest and a horizon where people are working on this are The River Keepers. This is a book by Robert Kennedy Jr. and Joe Cronin. And this is about how in the Hudson River area, the Fishermen's Association was concerned about the pollution of the Hudson River. Many of you know this story. And they saw these pipes coming from various industries, just dumping effluent into the Hudson, killing the fish stocks. So they had a meeting of the Fishermen's Association, and a lot of people were upset. So some said, well, we can just throw some dynamite into those, those pipes. So I said, yeah, well, we got some mattresses, we can stuff them. But fortunately, there was another person there from Sports Illustrated, the fishing editor, and said, well, you know, there's another solution. We have on the books a nuisance law in the United States. If anyone violates the commons, they create a common nuisance. If they're found guilty, they not only have to clean it up, but they will be sued, and money will then go to preserve the commons. So the River Keepers was born, and Robert Kennedy Jr., as a lawyer, was part of this. So they began to patrol the Hudson River. And he organized a graduate seminar, or a seminar of his law students, at Pace University Law School, and they became his team. And they would go after Exxon, they would go after, and they won multi-million dollar suits against these guys. But apropos your question, one morning they're looking through field glasses at this Exxon tanker, and they see it just, you know, spill all its effluent and bilge and residue oil into the Hudson River. Then it goes up a piece and then just starts intaking the water. They find out it's going to the Caribbean and selling it as pool water. So they sue them and are successful. But this is happening surreptitiously. It's funny because I told this story to one of my students in a classroom, like to my students, and a student came up and said, "That's funny you mentioned that because I just vacationed in the Caribbean." And when they found out I was from Canada, they said, "Oh, you should be right at home. Our pool water just has Lake Ontario water in it. It was just filled." Mm-hmm. So this is going on. But on a kind of happier note, they've been very successful in cleaning up the Hudson. So today, all the original fish stocks are back in the Hudson River. And they're plentiful because the water has been cleaned up to a great extent. Still a long way to go. There are now beavers in the East River. There's beaver dams that school trips now go to. And when the first beaver emerged was seen in the East River, maybe about 15, 17 years ago, they called it Jose after one of the local city councilmen who had been championing clean water. So Jose now has lots of families and there's lots of beaver dams in the East River of New York City. And people are now kind of making diagrams of platforms of pool areas and swimming. They're acting as if this is a floating pool and they're swimming in the Hudson River now. So it has come a long way. Part of that is the work of the riverkeepers.